Right. We were discussing verses 1 through 23. And by way of introduction, I contended that this entire chapter called the Olivet Discourse, Mark 13, speaks of Christ's cross and the second coming, and Christ's cross implies or entails the events surrounding and leading up to 70 AD, the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple. In the first 23 verses, the cross and the destruction of the temple are in view, and we argued that last week. Since then, some of you have raised questions in a very nice way indeed, such as, how can one prediction refer to three different or separate events? First coming, 70 AD, and the second coming of Christ. My answer to this is, although we are talking about three different historical events, we are talking about only one concept. Only one biblical or prophetic concept, namely the day of the Lord. In the Old Testament, the day of the Lord was always understood to begin at the house of the Lord, or with the people of the Lord, that being ancient Israel. Judgment must begin at the house of God. But then, of course, the day of the Lord was also applicable, very much so, to the nations of the world who also would fall under God's judgment. So, the day of the Lord is a broad concept encompassing both God's people and all the tribes and nations of the world. And to get a little more insight into this concept, let me give you a couple of references from the Old Testament to illustrate what I am saying. Turn to Isaiah chapter 2, verse 6. A reference to the day of the Lord. Isaiah 2, verse 6. For you have rejected your people, the house of Jacob, because they are full of things from the east and of fortune tellers like the Philistines, and they strike hands with the children of foreigners. Then going down to verse 10, enter into the rock and hide in the dust from before the terror of the Lord and from the splendor of His majesty. The haughty looks of man shall be brought low, and the lofty pride of men shall be humbled. And the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. That's the day of the Lord. In this particular passage, the day of the Lord refers to the children of Israel. And the day of the Lord would culminate in the most unbelievable of all judgments, namely the destruction of the status symbol, of the covenant between Yahweh and His chosen people Israel, that being Jerusalem, and in a narrow sense, the temple in Jerusalem. In Jeremiah chapter 4, we have another reference. Turn to Jeremiah chapter 4, verse 9. Here again, talking about the destruction of the day of the Lord. In that day, says Jeremiah in chapter 4, verse 9, declares the Lord, courage shall fail from both king and officials, the priests shall be appalled and the prophets astounded. Then I said, Ah, Lord God, surely you have utterly deceived this people and Jerusalem, saying, it shall be well with you, whereas the sword has reached their very lives. Then going down to verse 13, Behold, he comes up like clouds, his chariots like the whirlwind, his horses are swifter than eagles. Woe to us, for we are ruined. O Jerusalem, wash your heart from evil, that you may be saved. How long shall your wicked thoughts lodge within you? For a voice declares from Dan and proclaims trouble from Mount Ephraim. Warn the nations that he is coming. Announce to Jerusalem, besiegers come from a distant land. They shout against the cities of Judah. Like keepers of a field are they against her all around, because she has rebelled against me. In the following verses, then, the prophet describes the destruction of the city, including, of course, the temple. The fruitful land is turned into a desert, and all the cities of Judah, including Jerusalem, are laid in ruins before the Lord, before his fierce anger. So there is an understanding in the Old Testament prophets that the day of the Lord connects with the destruction of the temple, and the temple, of course, is a status symbol of the relationship, the covenant between God and Israel. You can add other texts to this, like Lamentations, for example, chapter 2, verse 1. How the Lord in his anger has set the daughter of Zion under a cloud. He has cast down from heaven to earth the splendor of Israel. He has not remembered his footstool in the day of his anger. The footstool is a sanctuary, is the temple. And then verses 6 through 8, he has laid waste his tent, that being the sanctuary as well, like a garden, laid in ruins his meeting place. The Lord has made Zion forget festival and Sabbath, and in his fierce indignation has burned king and priest. The Lord has scorned his altar, disowned his sanctuary. He has delivered into the hand of the enemy the walls of her palaces, and so forth. Now, all of these references converge upon one idea, and that is that the day of the Lord for the people of God centers on the destruction of the temple. Okay? And that destruction, in a wider sense, concerns all of Judah and all of Israel. Because if the temple is destroyed, so is the relationship between God and his people, and that's the ultimate death sentence for Israel. That being the case, let's return now to Mark 13 and once again remember how this text is introduced. Mark 13 begins with a question concerning the temple in Jerusalem, and concerning that temple, Jesus says, "Do you see these great buildings?" Verse 2, "There will not be left here one stone upon another that will not be thrown down." This is the prediction of the destruction of the temple, the physical edifice on Mount Zion. From here, however, we must also think of the day of the Lord as not only concerning Israel, but also the nations. The two are really one. No one gets away before the Lord. All will be subject to judgment. So as the temple is being thrown down or destroyed, And the covenant between Israel and God is being is becoming obsolete. So also the temple, being a symbol of the entire cosmos or the entire creation, so also the creation, the nations, and all that is in creation will be subject to judgment. The judgment on the temple is really only a foretaste of what is to come. And now understand that this has always been the pattern in Old Testament history. Judgment begins with Jerusalem and then moves on to those who oppress Judah or Israel. The nations also get their share of judgment. And this is what we have in Mark 13. In this sense, it is very much in line with prophecy in the Old Testament. It is very much like what you would read in Isaiah, Jeremiah, or in Ezekiel, for that matter. Now, in the Old Testament time period, the one event that brought to fulfillment these prophecies concerning the destruction of Jerusalem and the temple was 587, when the Babylonians destroyed not only the city, but also razed the temple. It was to be rebuilt, to be sure, in the days of Ezra and Nehemiah. And yet, when Jesus here speaks of another destruction of the temple, this one is in a different category, or is more ultimate. It is more final than even 587 BC. In many ways, it's parallel to 587 BC, but it is also bringing to a conclusion God's plan of salvation. In other words, what Jesus speaks about is the beginning of the end of the world. And the end of the world in Mark 13 is described in terms of the day of the Lord. Judgment on the temple, the people of the temple as well, judgment on the world. These two are really one event. So, in answer to the question, how can this prediction, Mark 13, deal with three different historical events, you need to think like an Old Testament prophet. And Jesus, although being far more than a prophet, also spoke as a prophet. And here he certainly does. You must think like an Old Testament prophet and understand that the concept of the day of the Lord gathers up all of these ideas and they become one in the counsel of God. So whether you talk cross or whether you talk the final judgment at the end of the world, that's really one concept, even though they're separated by time. 70 AD, as I said, is really part of the cross. It's a logical outgrowth of the crucifixion of the Son of God by His people. Before I continue, are there any questions? Any questions concerning this? Now that's encouraging. So in our last study in the Olivet Discourse, we saw that verses 1 through 23, and that's an identifiable text unit with a certain measure of closure. And I'm not going to go into the details again, but we saw that 1 through 23 is most likely an apocalyptic preview of the end of the world conceived in terms of the cross in 70 AD as part of the cross. Part of the deal of this judgment, this day of the Lord. Today, we have a brief section that stands out in this Olivet Discourse. I'm going to read this to you and then comment on it, beginning now in verse 24 and through verse 27. We read, "But in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will be falling from heaven, and the powers of the heavens will be shaken. And then they will see the Son of Man coming in clouds with great power and glory, and then He will send out the angels and gather His elect from the four winds, from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven." I'd like to draw your attention to a couple of general features of this brief section in the Olivet Discourse. First, if you study this chapter, Mark 13, carefully, you will find that with verse 24, there's a break, simply because the language clearly suggests sequence. It says here, "but in those days," and I will comment on this phrase in a few minutes, "but in those days after that tribulation." That tribulation is an anaphoric reference. It means it wants you to think in terms of something that has been said earlier. It leads you up in the discourse to a place where this phrase, "that tribulation," or the word "tribulation," has been used before. And as you look back, yes, indeed, you'll find this word in verse 19. "In those days," again, the same phrase that we also have in verse 24. There will be such tribulation as has not been from the beginning of the creation, nor ever will be. So it is beyond a shadow of a doubt that tribulation refers to verse 19. But since it says after that tribulation, we are here entering a time frame that must lead us beyond the cross and 70 AD, since 1 through 23 is concerned with these. That's very logical and very grammatical, in fact. The language is, if taken seriously, clearly leading you into a different time frame, even though it is still the same in those days. And I again will comment on this in just a few minutes. Or maybe I should do this now, because I don't see a reason to postpone this. Let me ask you this question. How or what in the world, what in the world do you make of the phrase "in those days"? You've seen it here, you've seen it in verse 19. No? What does it mean? John. Yeah, that's right. It's a period of time. That's important. It's not only one day, but a period. And how would you translate "in those days"? What does it mean? The end. Okay, exactly. A period of time that concerns the end. And now again, if you think like a prophet, you hear Jesus speaking like a prophet, because how often in the prophets of the Old Testament have you heard the phrase "in the latter days" or "in those days"? It's all over the place. When the prophets predict the messianic reign or some aspect of the judgment that pertains to the messianic reign, they will say, "In those days, the mountain of the house of the Lord will be exalted above all the mountains of the earth, and all the nations will flock to this sanctuary." "In those days" is a prophetic expression concerning the latter days, or simply the last days. Now, "in those days" is very inclusive. It, from our perspective, which is more informed than the perspective of the Old Testament prophet, "those days" refers to the cross, certainly, and it refers to the second coming of Christ as well. It encompasses anything that happens in these last days. As the writer to the Hebrews would have it, he calls the days in which you and I live "these last days." And "in those days" is a prophetic reference to these last days. So, in this sense, and that is why verse 24 can say, we are still in the same time frame, the big one, the big period of "in those days," the last days, but it is still a sequence here, leading from the tribulation to whatever is described in verses 24 through 27, which must happen after the tribulation. Okay? Do you have a question? Do you follow this? All right, then let me draw your attention to another peculiar feature of this section in the Olivet Discourse, and that is the feature of sweeping cosmic language. You can look elsewhere, you can scour the speech of Jesus in Mark 13, but you won't find something quite like what you have in 24 through 27. It must be acknowledged that the quality of this language is decidedly different from the rest of Mark 13, and therefore also warrants that you're dealing with a unique referent. Okay, something different from what we have seen so far. Notice that the language here is as cosmic as it could be, as global as it could be. Verse 27 the four winds, the ends of the earth, the ends of the heavens, and even before that, the cosmic conflagration like sun being darkened, moon not giving its light, and the stars falling from heaven, the powers in the heavens being shaken. This language will only occur at this point in the Olivet Discourse, and it does set this passage apart from its context. So it does seem to warrant, or at least suggest, that the referent of this language, what it refers to, is also somewhat unique. Now let's keep this simple. Since we're dealing with a time after the tribulation, and since last week we argued convincingly, as I would argue, and maintain that tribulation refers to the cross, including 70 AD. Since then, we have entered a time frame after the cross in 70 AD. We're only left with two viable options for in those days after that tribulation. What are the two viable options? John. Everything after that, that would include also these days in which we live. And that's possible. Even though the language may not make you think about the New Testament period, it's possible. For example, the sun being darkened and the moon and the stars falling from heaven, or not giving its light and the stars falling from heaven, that can simply be apocalyptic language describing a situation that perhaps could best be put in saying the world will never be the same. It's the end of the old world. And when the gospel is proclaimed, something is unleashed upon the world that does herald the end of the world as we know it. In some sense, in a spiritual sense, the language here could refer to the preaching of the gospel. What happens when people hear the gospel? They see the Son of Man with power and great glory, because their eyes are open, and they acknowledge the reign of Christ, which otherwise remains invisible and unacknowledged. But with the preaching of the gospel, the kingdom is already present. And in that sense, the language can refer to the entire New Testament period. Then also, the gathering of the elect, as in verse 27, from the four winds and from the ends of the earth to the ends of heaven, that can refer to the salvation of God's elect. As they hear the gospel, they gather it into the kingdom. Also, the word angelos in Greek, here translated angels, does not necessarily mean angel. Although most of the time it may, in the New Testament at least it may, though not in extra-biblical literature, but it can refer to messengers, simply human messengers who proclaim the gospel. So again, that's a possible interpretation. But I would say this is still less likely. The other option, more specific, is what? What other option do you have? The second coming of Christ. That's right. The judgment day and the consummation of our salvation, as verse 27 refers to that concept as well. And let me give you a couple of reasons for this. Before I pay attention or make us pay attention to the words of our text, let me first of all go back to Daniel chapter 7 and verses 10 through 13. And I feel that we need to do this because Jesus' language of the Son of Man coming in clouds is without question an allusion to Daniel chapter 7, 10 through 13. Now, in verses 10 through 12, we read, and this is a situation of judgment day. The books are opened, the Ancient of Days appears, and the throne is set. A stream of fire issued and came out from before him. Thousands of thousands served him, and 10,000 times 10,000 stood before him. The court sat in judgment, and the books were opened. Now, without any further reference, you would see this to be a picture of what? What's this a picture of? The second, judgment day, the second coming. But then we read further. It says, I looked, then because of the sound of the great words that the horn was speaking and so forth. And then in verse 13, actually this is an interlude, I didn't want to read this. But verse 13, this is what I really was driving at. I saw in the night visions, and behold, with the clouds of heaven, there came one like a son of man. Now what Jesus says in verse 24 of our text, Mark 13, 24, clearly refers to this. There's no doubt about this. Every commentator agrees on that. That's not even an issue. However, what is an issue is the question, does this coming in the clouds refer to the first or the second coming, or possibly both? And I argue, both. It lumps the first and second coming of Christ together. Notice, the Son of Man comes to the Ancient of Days and is presented before him. Now that sounds very much like Christ's ascension after his death on the cross, right? And I agree, that is how I would read this. This is the most logical historical referent to this language. But the text goes on to say, and to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom, and all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. So with the coming of the Son of Man and the beginning of his reign, you have an eternal kingdom that begins and goes on forever. That means that the first and the second coming are both in view.